Welcome back to the Garden with Joy and Holly radio show. Charlotte Wiggins moments away, but first...
Are you worrying about your plant growth? Then provide your plants with what they need to grow to their potential with Simple Grow. Simple Grow offers 100% organic worm castings at simplegrow.com. Unlike other worm casting products, when you order from Simple Grow, you are getting 100% worm castings, not filler plus castings. You can promote ideal soil structure and aeration with Simple Grow's all-natural and odor-free worm castings. There's only one ingredient, worm castings. No chemicals or additives will seep into your food.
Say it with more pizzazz. Only worm castings.
Only worm castings.
There you go.
There's only one ingredient, worm castings. No chemicals or additives will seep into your food, and it doesn't smell like other fertilizers. For indoor and outdoor use, order by the bag, bundle, ton, or truckload. Check out what Simple Grow can do for you at simplegrow.com.
Well, Holly, let's go to the Proclamation Hotline, brought to you by Proclamation Goods, and bring in our guest for this week.
Charlotte Wiggins gardens on a one-acre hillside garden in the central Missouri. She is a beekeeper, author, and founder of Bluebird Gardens. Her book is A Beekeeper's Diary, Self-Guide to Keeping Bees. Welcome to the program, Charlotte.
Thanks, Holly. Good to be here. Hi, Joey.
Well, we are happy that you've taken time out of your busy schedule, not only to educate Holly and myself, but also all of our listeners across the country, and we look forward to having this conversation with you. So with that,
delighted to be here.
Well, we're happy you are. Most people think of honeybees when it comes to beekeeping. Is that the most common bee to beekeep with or not? Or what is, I guess, would be what is the misconception maybe a lot of people think when it comes to, oh, bees, honey, that type of thing?
I think that's a correct assumption. Apis mellifera, the western honeybee, is the most kept or managed honeybee in North America. It is not an endangered bee, which is the misconception. The native bees are the ones that are being challenged right now with the loss of habitat. The honeybees are managed like you do chickens or cows or goats. They are a managed a community of bees, whereas the native bees, you know, are pretty much on their own, and they don't have the help that they need.
So the native bees, I'm going to refer this like the Asian carp is destroying the other species because it's overtaking the pot. So it's not like the honeybee or the bumblebee is destroying the habitat for the native bee. We're doing that on their behalf, kind of.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And bumblebees are considered to be native bees, whereas the honeybees are the managed bees.
Okay, great. And so what should people really consider before, you know, they want to keep bees or start keeping bees or invest in that equipment and whatnot?
Well, that's a really good question because it's very expensive and it's a challenging field to get into. If you've never been a biologist, especially, you are entering the world of the bees. So you need to learn the terminology that beekeepers use because it is a very different language, like a lot of specialties. It helps to read a lot of books. Be careful of YouTube channel videos because there are a lot of them out there, but not necessarily appropriate to your area. Beekeeping is very local. And so a technique that you may find in Georgia may not be applicable in Milwaukee, for example. Go to local bee clubs. There are local bee clubs around the country. Meet other beekeepers, volunteer to help somebody who has hives or has an apiary so you can get a close-up experience with that. If you're in an area that doesn't have a local bee club, I just launched my second edition of the Bee Club Basics, which gives you a guide on how to start an educational nonprofit to support your local beekeeping community. Your success will depend on sharing information among other beekeepers. And so that's a really important step to develop a relationship with somebody else who's in your area keeping bees. Matter of fact, the Heroes to Hives program, which teaches veterans how to beekeep around the country, tells you to not keep bees, get bees until your second year. Go through online training, go to teaching apiaries, get your hands in a hive so that you can get comfortable and get over that scared to death feeling, and then get your bees, because at that point you should be better, more successful in managing them.
Now, I know what I need to know, and I'm just going to do it. Is there certain requirements, legalities, permits that one needs to obtain based on where they're at to even allow them legally?
Oh, absolutely. Check into your local ordinances and statutes, because some communities limit how many hives you can have or where you can have them.
Or if you can do it at all.
Simply with chickens or goats or horses. So make sure you know your legal requirements in your community before you do this.
Definitely. That is really helpful. So now, could you tell us more about your book, A Beekeeper's Diary, A Self-Guide to Keeping Bees? And why should our listeners check it out?
Sure. Well, I started teaching beginning beekeeping 10 years ago at the request of our local extension office, and used to develop these handouts that became editions over the years and were in a loose leaf binder for the last couple of years. And I decided that it was just kind of crazy to be making all these copies when I could make it into a book. And so The Beekeeper's Diary is both a guide to keeping bees with a pest and disease section, and how to artificially feed if you need to, and what the challenges are, what kind of equipment you need, as well as helpful checklists that as you're starting, you can follow. There's 14 decisions, for example, you have to make on where to place your hives. And that checklist helps you stay on track and not forget something, because it's hard to remember when you're starting. There's a lot of information that you have to take in when you're starting. And that book has also been certified by the Great Plains Master Beekeeping Program out of the University of Nebraska at Lincoln as having scientifically based best management practices. That's the other part of beekeeping. I've had a club here since 2014, and we see people coming to us frustrated because they didn't get a good start with the fundamentals. If you learn the basics early, you then can build on that and increase your success. So that's what that book is designed to do. Some people cannot get to a club, can't get to a class, but they can at least pick up that book and get a start. And then if they do go to a class, I use it in my classes as well, they will have something to take home to help them, you know, be reminded of the 9 hours they just went through in a class about all the decisions they have to make.
Well, congratulations on that certification, on that book. That's like an Oscar.
Thank you.
Because that means a lot. That's like the Bible of beekeeping, essentially.
It's really nice to have professionals look at it and say, oh, yeah, this is a good product. Yeah,
you know what you're doing. Good job.
Thank you.
Now, you talked about location of hive. And it all depends on, and I know enough about beekeeping to get all of us in trouble here. You based on what flowers the bees pick up and bring back to the hive can greatly affect the flavor in which the honey that they're making has.
Yes.
And
yes.
And it all depends on, you got to keep them so far away from this and that and all that. And that's what that book covers in great detail.
Right. And, you know, you're really keeping two insects in a hive these days. Yes, you're keeping a honeybee, but you're trying to keep the numbers of the varroa mite, which is an invasive tick that now has spread throughout the world, except for Australia. You're wanting to keep the varroa numbers low. The varroa mite basically consumes the fat body, which is like the liver of the bees, and leaves them without any defense mechanism. And then they vector over like four dozen viruses that the varroa carry. And so you want to keep the varroa numbers low and your honeybee numbers high. So it's a very delicate balance, because you don't want to kill your honeybees. And what you need to manage varroa can kill your bees. So you have to learn. We're amateur biologists and scientists at this stage to be successful beekeepers. You can use integrated pest management. There's steps of like pulling out the male drone brood early spring if you don't need to have drones to mate with your queens, because that's where the varroa mites reproduce, inside the larger comb, wax comb where the drones are raised. You can split your hives. You can do things that don't require the use of chemicals. But that's intensive to do that and stay on top of it and constantly monitor the levels of varroa in your hive. So it's not an easy process. It's not inexpensive. It's time consuming. And you really are entering the world of bees. You're not telling the bees what to do. You are learning what the bees need and learning when you can engage with them to help them without hurting them. So it's a fine, delicate balance you have to learn.
Well, how can we help us non-beekeepers? How can we help the native bee species? What can we do in our everyday life?
Absolutely simplest thing to do plant native trees, shrubs, and flowers. Those native species have a relationship with those native bees. There's some, there's a bee, I forget the name of it now. It's a blueberry, a bumblebee that only collects nectar and pollen off blueberry bushes that are grown in a certain part of Maine, for example. So those relationships have evolved over millions of years, and they're codependent, right? The bee is codependent to the plant and vice versa. The plants, depending on the bees for reproduction services, and the bees, depending on the plants for food, nectar for flight fuel, and food for their babies. So plant those native plants and make sure that you have them matched to your soil type. The good news is if you're brand new to gardening and brand new to growing things, those native plants will be very successful because they're already acclimated to your weather conditions, your climate, to your soils. Just make sure you're matching them correctly to your soils and you're keeping them hydrated that first year. It's always surprising to me that people think, well, natives don't need water. Yes, they still need water to get established. But that's the most important thing we all can do is plant more flowers.
That's really helpful to know. So thank you for that. So what is, you know, we're approaching early summer here, and what is your favorite, one of your favorite early summer things in the garden, you know, whether it be a plant that blooms or just something you enjoy doing in the garden in early summer, what is one of your favorite parts of early summer in the garden?
Oh, you know what? I garden on a 1 acre limestone hillside where my neighbors said nothing would grow. And I've been here 37 years. I have over 50 dwarf fruit trees. And I take a walk every morning, and I love to see what's happening in the garden, particularly on those fruit trees. And this year, I'm so excited because I actually have fuzzy pears and nectarines now showing. I had my first Bing cherry last year. Don't ask me how much that cost over the years, but boy, it was delicious. And I also, I often have to beat the squirrels to the ripe fruit, but this year it's going to be a bumper crop. I think the plants have finally found their way through the limestone. Their roots have, and now, you know, they root the first year, they shoot the second year, they fruit the third year. Well, here on limestone, it can take 10 years for them to do that cycle. So they're finally, some of the older trees are finally getting to the point where they're fruiting. So I love discovering the fruit, even if they're baby little, you know, little tiny baby fruits on my fruit trees.
When you moved there, was it when the neighbors said, oh, nothing will grow there, was that a challenge for you? Was you like, watch this? Or was it just something that you decided, well, let's try it?
Well, no, actually, it was. I've always been a gardener. My family goes back hundreds of years to Hungary. We were farmers back then, even strawberry farmers in Louisiana when they immigrated to the U.S. You know, I just looked at them. I mean, I didn't want grass.
Right.
That's what they had. Their idea of gardening was planting turf grass, and I wanted flowers. I like cut flowers. And so I just listened to that, and I said, well, okay, I know it's going to be a little harder. And I think I have one friend who still comes back periodically to see what I'm doing, and he's just amazed at what's happened on this hillside. It's been a lot of work. It's bringing in mulch and composting everything and just taking my time. I have trees that take 30 years to show any kind of growth, but we're getting there, you know, so patience helps a lot. I don't expect things to grow overnight, and I just like growing things, so I haven't been bothered too much about that.
Fantastic. Well, we've really enjoyed having you on the program today. Can you tell us how people can find out more about you?
Sure. They can go to charlotteeckerwiggins.com. I also blog at Gardening Charlotte, at Home Sweet Bees, and a teaspoon, where I have fun. I joke about playing with my food. If I grow something, I may make something with it, and I'll feature that on the blogs. And they can find links to the blogs at bluebirdgardens.com, which is my custom gift company.
And your book is available there as well?
It is. That's the only place to get autographed copies is at Bluebird Gardens.
Well, Charlotte, we greatly appreciate the time that you have offered to Holly and myself and all of our listeners and the knowledge you've shared with us in the short amount of time we've had. Thank you so much. Absolutely.
For more information, please visit thewisconsinvegetablegardener.com.